This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly look at the best in architecture, craft, furniture, and fashion. I'm Nolan Giles. On today's show, we head to Southern California to marvel at the modernist architecture that can be found in Palm Springs. Author Sam LaBelle shares the city's architectural history with us. We meet the organizers behind the world-famous Modernism Week, and we hear about how new homes can complement the existing buildings that made the town famous. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design. Do stay tuned. Palm Springs, a small city in the desert of Southern California, is best known for its mid-century modern buildings. So much so, it's a mecca for architecture lovers, design-savvy home buyers, and the setting for countless films and television shows. Author, curator, and architecture critic Sam LaBelle has written 8 books about design, but his mid-century modern architecture travel guide is indispensable for anyone looking to visit Palm Springs. Let's hear from LaBelle now to better understand how Palm Springs became home to so many iconic mid-century residences.
The essential element that defines mid-century modern, as the name suggests, is the time period. And that's essentially pretty much from after World War II, until sort of the early 1970s. And modernism, of course, was a movement in architecture and in other arts and other forms of life. Modernism is sort of coming to terms with modern life, and starting before mid-century, even in the sort of 20s and 30s, out of the Bauhaus and architects like Corbusier and Mies van der Rohe and Walter Gropius, this idea that we're now living in a modern society, kind of growing out of the Industrial Revolution, and that we have to sort of embrace that in our architecture and embrace the future and embrace technology and science. Mid-century kind of grew out after World War II. There were a lot of new materials and a lot of new techniques, a lot of them growing out of the war itself. And so there was a lot of technology like steel was being used more. Glass is obviously already being used, but in much larger expanses. Things like plastics and fiberglass. And so these were things that were really being done quite a bit in mid-century modern. And I think when it comes to places like Palm Springs, you had mid-century modern that really took on the regional characteristics of a place. And all of Southern California, obviously, you have this kind of beautiful weather and this kind of rugged landscape. West Coast really embraced modernism. It was sort of coming of age, so to speak, at the time when mid-century modernism was also coming, you know, becoming at the forefront. And Palm Springs was sort of this, you know, amazing escape from Los Angeles. All these celebrities were starting to go there. And you have architects like Albert Frey, who you know, certainly part of the Bauhaus movement and modernist movement, coming out there and introducing it. And it was sort of the perfect place for it because mostly you had people living there in the winter. They didn't live there full time. So you could sort of experiment a little bit more. Plus, it was outside of the kind of spotlight of LA, and you had, you know, the desert. So it's sort of this starting over kind of feeling. And they kind of said, well, we can, you know, let's see what we can do here. So it was very, very experimental. And that was perfect for a place like Palm Springs, perfect for modernism. And once this kind of modernism took hold, that's what Palm Springs became known for. And people like Frank Sinatra, you know, who originally didn't want to have a modern house, E. Stuart Williams was his architect, convinced him to build a modern house. And then all these celebrities started doing it. And we know from now, with the whole influencer culture, how that kind of, you know, happens. And then also you have photographers like Julia Shulman that are getting the word out and magazines. And it becomes a thing, for lack of a better word.
Her desert sands, her snow, and yes, her beaches.
It was really glorifying more than anything the place, more than the architecture. These large glass walls and sliding glass doors and clear story windows, bringing in the sun, bringing in the wind, bringing in this kind of amazing landscape. In some ways, you know, being inspired by the landscape with these sort of angled roofs and sometimes zigzag roofs and these kind of concrete block screens that, like, you know, protect you from the sun but also let in the wind. It was really oriented incredibly well for this particular landscape, and that's what modernism was really able to do. You're building something that suits this place perfectly. But then by sort of the 1970s, modernism in general was starting to become less popular. I think people were tiring of it and looking for something new. Modernism sort of went out of favor for a while, for almost a couple of decades. And then by kind of the 90s, early 2000s, it started to become popular again. You had, you know, photographers like Julius Schumann, who I mentioned before. His stuff started to become more popular. People started to realize this is something amazing that we've sort of forgotten about. It sort of had this second renaissance, and Palm Springs, which had sort of dropped off the map for a while because of its architecture, people started becoming interested in coming back, or events like Palm Springs Modernism Week, which has been around almost 20 years, and that started to draw thousands of people back to Palm Springs. And then all of a sudden it was hot again, and it's incredibly popular now. Everybody wants a modernist house in Palm Springs. Always have trouble picking my favorites, but I have to say it's not original by any means, but the Kaufman House by Richard Neutra is just spectacular place, and it was made famous by Julius Schulman in his pictures that sort of captured the the mountains behind it and people at the pool. So you have the lifestyle, you have the kind of incredible setting, it kind of captured everything. But that house, I was lucky enough to go. The former owner, this was years ago, invited myself and my writing partner, Greg Golden, after a panel to go visit. And we went there at sunset, and you just, you sit there and you get it. You're on a porch, in the mountains, and the sun setting behind you, and feel the breeze coming in, and you're looking at this little landscape in this house. You get it very quickly why this appealed to people.
That was Sam Lubell there. He was speaking to Charlie Filmacourt. Now, Sam Lubell previously mentioned the renaissance of modernist architecture thanks to Modernism Week. The annual celebration of mid-century modern design includes many events, such as home tours, auctions, and exhibitions. This year's event had an in-person strand that came to a close last weekend, but the week's online experience is still available for a few weeks longer. To find out more about the significance of the week and its adaptations this year, I spoke to the event's executive director, Lisa Vossler-Smith.
Well, we've always had walking tours, and it wasn't until this year that I really appreciated what those offer, because you do get to visit neighborhoods and architecture at the street level, which is different than, reviewing it on screen or talking about things hypothetically or in other cities. So our guides actually lead neighborhood tours through the small streets of Palm Springs, very small group tours so that everyone can remain distanced. And that way we're able from the street to talk about the history of the neighborhood, the architects that built homes there, why some choices or decisions were made, and how it's affected the community over the last 50 or 60 years. And so they really get a more intimate view of architecture from the street level.
It's really interesting, this idea of these kind of architectural tours and walks. I spoke to someone recently in London who's just, had an incredible boom in appreciation for what he's doing in terms of his walking tours. Because I think people over the last year have kind of become interested in what's around them, and this idea of, walking around and looking at all this kind of incredible architecture and learning about this history, it has become maybe a bit more impactful for people. Do you agree?
I really do agree. And I think as we've all enjoyed, the little bit of outdoor recreation that we've been able to do safely, I know I have found myself walking in my own neighborhood more frequently with a little bit more time on my hands. And you do find yourself, marveling at different homes and wondering who lives there or what choices were made in their design decisions. And certainly in Palm Springs, where there is such a concentrated development of mid-century modern structures, it's a great opportunity to use it almost as an outdoor classroom because you can cover a pretty broad spectrum of design within just a few blocks.
Sounds amazing. I'm really interested in, I guess, the culture of these types of people that you speak to and the types of people that live in these houses, because at Monocle, we often cover, you know, really beautiful mid-century buildings. But typically, you know, they're in neighborhoods where other mid-century buildings have been knocked down and there's newer buildings. So the people that tend to buy and renovate these older buildings are people that really love and care about the architecture and, you know, it's, you know, their life's dream to live in a beautiful modernist house. But in Palm Springs, where, like you say, there are thousands of these homes, does it have that same sort of feeling, that same sort of culture, or do some people kind of take them for granted? What's the kind of mood of residents there when it comes to design?
Well, I would say no one takes it for granted because, of course, now we've brought into the spotlight how special these properties are. What does happen sometimes is people have either had these homes in their families for multiple generations now, and maybe it was their family's vacation home or second home, and they grew up visiting their grandparents there, and then their parents had the house. And so we've seen this many times where these mid-century properties are either handed down or sold into the same family. But the other thing that's true about Palm Springs, and I'm sure about many other cities, is that we have a lot of original owners. They have been in Palm Springs for many years, raised their families here, and kept their homes. And in some cases, they have not been remodeled. So it's really special when we come across a mid-century property that still has its original kitchen or its original bathrooms and really takes more of a preservation perspective when thinking about how to update or remodel their homes. They really want to leave its original character and structure intact. So there's a wonderful combination of both new homeowners that have come to Palm Springs over the years, as well as multi-generational families that have been longtime residents. And everyone remains committed to the preservation of these structures throughout the Coachella Valley here in Palm Springs.
And I'm going to go out on a little bit of a limb here and say that maybe Palm Springs would have been one of the nicest places to be living during this super difficult time over the last year. And I think part of the reason for that is because of these incredible modernist homes that people live in. You know, they're so light-filled, they're so generous with their space. A lot of them also have beautiful swimming pools. I'd love to kind of hear your take on that, because you're a lot more familiar with the place and the architecture than I am. Do you think that these buildings have kind of shown something about the quality of architecture back then that maybe we're missing a little bit now when it comes to the home, because we've all been stuck at home?
There is a simplicity in the form of modernist design, of course, and there is both a minimalist lifestyle in some ways, because you obviously can't have a lot of clutter in some of these modernist homes. It's just contrary to their intention design-wise. So I think you touched on a few things that are very important. And one is that throughout the pandemic, I never took for granted that when I look out my window, it is paradise. And it looks like I'm on a resort vacation, even though I'm here working from my home office. So even in the scariest of times, all I had to do was walk outside and take a breath of fresh desert air and take a look at the mountains and the palm trees and suddenly feel, you know, relaxed and rejuvenated. But also, I think having good design in your community allows for people to feel happiness and joy because of the atmosphere that they're in. So even just getting out to take a simple walk or taking a drive to see what's going on in your community, both you see the new and the old here in Palm Springs. And I don't just mean the people. I mean the structures, because we've had lots of new construction happening even over the last year. So it's been fun to watch development continue to progress, which gives us all a little ray of hope that there is a light at the end of the tunnel and that normal life will resume.
My thanks to Lisa Vossler-Smith there. For those of us unable to visit sunny Southern California, we can visit modernismweek.com, where a number of online experiences are still available. Palm Springs' fame is partly due to the iconic photographers who captured the works of equally iconic architects. The artist and photographer Jana Ireland's most recent book, Regarding Paul R. Williams, A Photographer's View, profiles the work of the architect behind Palm Springs' iconic town and country center, amongst other buildings. Let's hear more from Jana now about her approach to capturing Paul R. Williams' work.
When I was deciding what I wanted this work to look like, what made sense to me, thinking about someone who worked over the course of 50 years and designed in so many different architectural styles with so many different interior design trends and continuing past the time of his retirement up until today, in these houses, I wanted to find a way to unify all of these different structures designed different ways. And so shooting in black and white was a way of kind of leveling everything off, and meaning that we didn't have to think about a green shag carpet or gold wallpaper or anything that would potentially distract from the architecture itself. I wanted to create a sort of experiential overview of Paul R. Williams's work. So it's not a book that looks at one structure at a time and gives you information about it. It's not a book that's arranged in any kind of chronological order. It's more about looking at different things that he was interested in and different things that he was doing throughout his career, all put together so that you can flip through it and just get an idea of the things that he could do without having to focus on one particular thing at a time. I shot architecture kind of in a passive way before this project. It had been in the background of some things, some projects that I'd done, but never really central to my work. So for this project, I have to figure out what my photographs of architecture would look like and what about architectural photography I was interested in and what I wasn't interested in. So I was just trying to, shoot it in a way that made sense to me, shoot it in a way that didn't feel too commercial, shoot it in a way that also allowed the homeowners their privacy, so I'm not showing every part of every room and every piece of art and all of that. I think if you're looking at an entire view of a room, on one hand, it seems like you see everything, but on the other hand, it's potentially superficial. But if you live in a house and you're there every day, you'll begin to notice things like the way a particular corner of a room joins or the way light hits a particular part of a room at a particular time of day. So I was more interested in that experience of architecture than in an overview of any given space. Because of his connection to celebrities, what it means is that sometimes people don't know that he did all of these other things. He also designed housing projects. He also designed churches for various different communities. And I think that he was interested in people at all economic levels and people who belong to different parts of society and interested in doing work for all of them. And I think that that's something that made him really special as a person, in addition to being special as an architect. I think that this upcoming generation of Black architects has the potential to be more influenced by him than any other generation of Black architects, except maybe the really early ones when he was beginning his career, because so many architects I talked to didn't learn about him in school and didn't learn about his influence until much later, or just learning about it now. So because of all of this conversation about his work now, he's a figure who more and more architects will know about as they go through school and begin their careers. In just the time I've been doing this, I've seen an incredible amount of interest in his work build in the city. And I've also seen some houses illegally demolished before the neighbors could stop them, before people realized what was going on. I hope that his name being more well-known will make things like that harder to do, and will make it less likely that a Paul Williams house will be sold to someone who only wants the land underneath.
My thanks to Jana Island there. She was speaking to Charlie Filmer Court. Finally, on today's show, we ask the question, how do you construct new buildings in Palm Springs that complements its existing architectural vernacular? That's the question affordable housing developer Chalk hoped to answer by keeping its new Monarch apartments in line with that of its mid-century modern neighbours. Our show's producer, Maylie Evans, spoke with Maria Song. She is principal of Interactive Design Corporation and architect on the Monarch project, together with Chalk's CEO, Manuela Silva. Let's join their conversation, where Manuela outlines the process of getting the first approved affordable housing in the Palm Springs area for over a decade.
This piece of land had been owned by the city, and the city acquired it for the purpose of providing affordable housing, and had not had any successful applications or development processes over the last 12 years. Our approach to it was, here's a piece of land in a beautiful city surrounded by other architectural significant pieces. And we wanted to demonstrate how affordable housing could be incorporated and weaved into this fabric of this community without transforming or creating any architectural obstacles. And it was a process of engaging the community. What is it that you want to see there? What don't you want to see there? And how we could come together and implement a vision, and through design that was guided by the principles of the community. The design was key to the community approval and the community buy into it and support of it. I mean, we had planning commission meetings where the commissioners themselves stood up and applauded the project. That's how significant this is.
The way that we masked the buildings were equivalent to single family home sizes. We did not outstretch the footprint in order to make this like a long, singular building. We broke it down into pieces so that when they're placed on a major thoroughfare street and you're driving, you can see these breaks in between the buildings, and they're not ominous on the street. The second thing that we did is we also built one-story home next to the existing single-family homes. Again, we can be in scale when it comes to the existing home. So the neighborhood doesn't feel like, again, there's this ominous building right next to them. By law, we were able to design this many homes. They could have gone even to more units, but that would have meant that we would have to be massive and taking more footprint and not able to balance between outdoor and indoor spaces.
And Maria, I wondered if you could sort of tell me about some of the design decisions made to help foster a sense of community and encourage new tenants to congregate and to socialize with their neighbors.
So the way that the two-story apartments that were built, we had wide stairs, so people could have conversation while they're going up and down the stairs. Corridor balconies that are not narrow, but wide again. So we encourage social interaction. And in single family homes, you do that with deep overhangs and deep shade and shadow spaces at the entry of the home so you can greet your neighbors and so on. So we created that with the same principle, but we created that through the stairways and then the balcony corridors in front of every single apartment entrance.
My brain goes back to this idea of, or the misunderstanding of what affordable housing actually is and what it means. And maybe there being some sort of assumption that it might mean lower quality when it comes to building materials or construction. Manuela, maybe we could start with you, but what are some of the oversights that people have or misconceptions?
When we talk to the community about the possibility of building affordable housing in that neighborhood, the misconception always is that affordable housing is public housing, which is different. And so it was this educational process that affordable, really, it's not about the design, it's not about the construction, it's about the way a project is financed. That the affordable component, it's really related to how it's financed, not how it's built. And so that allows us to reduce the rental schedule to an affordable level. The income limits are not established to target low-income families, but actually to keep higher-income families from moving in. And just that little discussion and conversation around what affordable housing really means, that it should look like everything else in a community. It should respect the built environment. Sometimes people refer, the ones that object to the affordable housing in the neighborhood, they do so because they think it's going to degrade the neighborhood. They even refer to affordable cars parked on the street. And I don't know what an affordable or a low-income car looks like. But those are some of the objections.
It took 10 years for people to be slightly more open to the idea of having affordable housing next door to them. We're all, I think, all over the world, we're experiencing the problems of homelessness. And the biggest approach and what CHOP represents is that let's prevent people from becoming homeless. And the way you do that is you provide housing. If you are in an economic challenge, you're only a month away of becoming homeless. So by providing low-income housing, you can prevent that. So prevention rather than having to eradicate afterwards. The challenge is always about educating people and giving them examples of what really work. But what we're experiencing in California, and I know you experience this in metropolitan cities, is that the land is becoming so expensive that it makes it even more challenging for CHOC to acquire the land and be able to infill low-income housing for people who actually are in the service end, which brings us back to the importance of integrated cities.
And so this year, Modernism Week featured this project, the Monarch Apartments, in their digital strand. Maybe starting with you, Maria, why do you think you were featured? And I guess, how do you think the inclusion of this project helps wider conversations around affordable housing?
Modernism Week is about this era of time, right? Post-war, these star architect, Don Wexler, here in Palm Springs, that he's very well known. He was actually building houses that were prefabricated steel and windows, mass production. And you cannot believe, but those houses were $13,000 back then, okay? And those homes are right next to Monarch. They're the neighbors of Monarch. We very well respected the design and style of mid-century modern with this Monarch apartment. We look at the context and we look at the history, and then that's how we developed the design. The perfect sort of confluence of so many good things coming together. We use the big influence of mid-century modern. And the reason why I'm so excited about it is because we get to sort of continue that principle. We want to create the American life for families, and we have the chance to do that. The people who come and attend Modernism Week are people who want that era, you know, the beauty of that era, the cleanliness, the simpleness, the balance. They want that. And what perfect opportunity for us to have an educational moment in which, if they understand that, hey, this could also be done with affordable housing, maybe they could also be spokesperson for us when there are future projects like this, you know, coming around their neighborhood. What better audience than the sophisticated audience of Modernism Week to understand that affordable housing could also have amazing style.
My thanks to Emanuela Silva and Maria Song there. They were speaking with Maile Evans. And that's all the time we have on today's show. If you're keen for even more design-related listening, then catch our five-minute midweek sister show, Monocle on Design Extra. It airs every Thursday. Today's show was produced and edited by Maile Evans with editing assistance from Sean Hickey. Our studio managers are Steph Chungu and Louis Allen. Thanks to our researchers, Nick Moniz and Charlie Filmercourt. I'm Nolan Giles. Thank you very much for listening and goodbye.